other people put the thing together, but I'm certainly grateful that there are people who are capable of doing that and organizing something like this. I know it's a lot of work, and we really do appreciate it. This morning, I thought we might do a little review, go over what we've already looked at a little bit, and then build on up to step five, where we are in the book this morning. We looked at the... go ahead, Butch. Go ahead.
Well, what we've found in this book so far is some information that's going to help us do what we need to do to recover from alcoholism. First thing we needed to do was learn what alcoholism was, and they began to teach us that on the very first pages, and they told us that this book was going to show us precisely how we recovered, told us we were sick people. It gave us a little nutshell history of the Fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous and the forwards, and then we went through the doctor's opinion very carefully, because that was the medical estimate of what is wrong with us. We learned about powerlessness when we could see that we had no power to either stay away from alcohol because of the mental obsession, and we had no power to stop drinking once we started because of a physical allergy. And those things made us powerless over alcohol. They made our lives unmanageable, and they made it impossible for us to see the truth about many things. But once we could see the truth in print and believe it to be true about us, then we may have come to a conclusion that gave us the first step, the identification of the problem and the fact that I own it. That's my problem and I own it. In the problem, we found out that the solution was going to have to be power. This is all seems to be all about power. I tried all my life to find the power, and I must have looked in the wrong places because I didn't have the needed power. This is going to have to come from outside me. It's going to have to be a power greater than myself. And they gave us a lot of information and a lot of stories to let me find my way through that wall of prejudice that I had built to see if I might just come to suspect that I could be helped. That would be necessary if there's going to be any help for me. I've got to believe it can happen. And then we made a decision. We made a decision to either go back and live in step one, or hopefully to seek some spiritual help along with the information that we're given here. And then we started taking action. Most of the print, most of the text is just giving us information so that we can come to conclusions so that we'll be able to make a decision. And then in step four, we listed and analyzed the truth about how we think. Since my main problem centers in my mind and not in my body, then my mind is what's going to have to be repaired. And I need to see what's wrong with it before I put it in the shop and ask God to fix it. So I wrote down the common manifestations of self: resentment, fear, and guilt, shame, and remorse associated with the harms I've done other people. This showed me that it's really not who the people are in my life that I have resented all these years, and it's not the harms that I've done people, because I certainly did that. I harmed many people. But the problem was how I reacted to it. That turned out to be the only thing that I can change. That is what I asked to know the difference in the Serenity Prayer, is between, I need to know the difference between what has happened to me and my reaction to it. And I can see, as I look at my work, that line has become very blurred. What has happened to me actually becomes my reaction has actually become what has happened to me. And I think that I have been treated unfairly, and that turns out not to be the case. And we have some information that's going to be very important over the next 2 or 3 hours and for the rest of our life. Because what we're doing is we're learning to use a process that we will use every day from the time I wake up until the time I go to bed, and then it gives me some specific things to do at those times. But this is a walking around program. And the more I practice it, the better I will be at it, just as it would anything. If it were anything from baseball to cross stitch, the more I do it, then of course the easier it's going to be for me. And then I believe that I will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle me because I've practiced using the process. I have to go into the book, I have to use the paper in the beginning, but then it becomes a working part of the mind. And this morning, we are going to take a look at the work we've done, and we're going to try to get more truth out of what we're already looking at. It says into action, and I wrote down there, not thinking. So we're going to take more action. We're going to see what has to be done. We're going to see how our reactions affect us and how we can change them. We're going to identify those things that we're going to become willing to have changed in step 6. So this morning we're going to talk about step 5. Can you think of anything else today?
No, not really. I like to just go back and read that last paragraph again when we come out of step 4, the last two paragraphs. If we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We're getting down to the truth about the way we think about our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. I suspect that rattling is that radiation I went through. It's just not all gone yet.
Now you're glowing a little this morning.
I glow in the dark sometimes. In this book you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. And we've been given the definition of faith being the result of a course of action taken that we suspected might work. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. That, I believe, is the only moral issue in this whole program, is the things that shut me off from the sunshine of the Spirit. If you have already made a decision, step 3, in an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. And they use that phrase a lot, a good beginning, all through these steps, and that's what we're doing. We're making a beginning every day, a new beginning. Into action. Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we have admitted to God for forgiveness, to ourselves for honesty, and to another human being for humility, teachability, but not humiliation. The exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. This is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we have done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should do so. The best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they failed. We think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough of humility, fierceness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. Now, for some reason, we got confused in step four and thought step four was telling our whole life story. And the first four-step inventory that I did, I wrote 57 pages of my life story. I told everything that I could possibly remember, and I went over to the church and I read it to the priest, and he did the prayer of absolution. And on the way home, I thought, I knew everything I told that man. I've not learned anything. I knew when I was born, where I played football, what I did, when I drank, when I didn't drink, and I didn't learn anything from that.
I'd like to say something. I'd like to pull out my dictionary right there, if we can. And I looked up story one time, and I wondered how we got so mixed up on that. And the definition I found that I believe fits here is account. In other words, this is where I account for my behavior. And I don't know how much money I have until I account for it, certainly. So therefore, I do not know what needs to be changed until I have an accounting. And that's the definition that helps me the most. And we did get a little bit off track when we thought that that's what they wanted us to do in step four. But that helped me. Account for the truth. Go ahead, Bob.
More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. We had to, didn't we? He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he does not deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he is revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension. He's restless, irritable, and discontented. That makes for more drinking. You remember in the doctor's opinion, he said that's the reason we always go back to drinking. We're restless, irritable, and discontented when we're not drinking. And we start remembering the sense of ease and comfort that we got from taking a few drinks. And imagination overcomes willpower, and we take a drink and we trigger the allergy, and then we're drunk again. I can certainly relate to that part of, you know, doing things when you're intoxicated, and then when you sober up and you realize what you've done. But also, by the same token, I've done some things that I knew I had to be drunk to excuse doing. And I remember one thing in particular I did that I needed to balance between oblivion and shakes. I need to balance between being able to perform and having an excuse for doing it. So I drank just so much and I could still do that. So the next morning, I knew what I was going to do, and I knew it was wrong. But I knew that the next morning I had to have that excuse of, I wouldn't have done that if I hadn't have been drunk. So that tells me a little bit about my thinking preceded the taking the next first drink, is I had to have that drink to excuse my actions that I knew I was going to do anyway. Psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We have spent thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we have given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. Small wonder many in the medical profession have a low opinion of alcoholics and their chance for recovery. We must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long or happily in this world. Rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. Those of us belonging to a religious denomination which requires confession must, and of course, will want to go to the properly appointed authority whose duty it is to receive. Now, right here, let me just say that this program was put in a book in 1939, and at that time there was not a great deal of meetings and a great, they just didn't have the sponsorship that we have now. Though we have no religious conviction, we may still do well to talk with someone ordained by an established religion. We often find such persons quick to see and understand our problem. Of course, we sometimes encounter people who do not understand alcoholics. Now, in my opinion, the person that understands the alcoholic the best is an alcoholic who has taken step five with his sponsor. And he knows what to do, and he knows how to do it, he knows the benefits, and he knows what to point out to me and not point out to me. If we cannot or would not rather do this, we search our acquaintances for a closed-mouthed, understanding friend. Perhaps our doctor or psychologist will be the person. It may be one of our own family, but we cannot disclose anything to our wives or parents which will hurt them and make them unhappy. We have no right to save our own skin at another person's expense. Such parts of our story we tell to someone who will understand yet be unaffected. Now, it took me a long time. I didn't see that for a long time. And what it's saying to me is that I don't necessarily have to do my whole fifth step with one person. I can tell one person most of it, and then if there's something that I think would hurt that person or would not be beneficial, that I could choose another person to tell that to. But I didn't do that. I told it all. I unloaded. And when we got through, Charlie and I had been riding around. We went back to the old Parmley plantation and where the family settled in Kentucky. And we spent 3 or 4 days just riding around the country and me talking all the time, I was doing my fifth step. And we got home and we had one day. Judy was gone, my wife was gone. And we had one day and we were going to finish it up, and I got the written form out and handed it to Charlie, except for the last sheet. And there was something written on that sheet that I had no intentions of ever telling another human being as long as I lived. That was one thing that would never, ever be told. I simply would not allow anybody to know that about me. And when we got through, he said, "Is that all? Are you through?" And I said, "Yeah, that's it. I don't have anything else. I've told you everything I know about me." In a few minutes, he said, "Are you sure that's it?" And I said, "Yeah, that's it. I don't have anything else." And a few more minutes, he said, "Now, Judy will be home in a few minutes. If you've got anything else, we need to work it out. We need to talk about it before she gets here." And I said, "Well, Charlie, I can assure you that there was one more thing." And I told him what that one more thing is, and he said, "Bob, there's always one more thing, and it's always that." And he shared with me his experience in that same area. And he said, "At home when I listen to a fifth step, and they leave, they go get in their car and they leave, I get me a cup of coffee and go sit down on the front porch and just wait on them, because in a few minutes I'll see that cloud of dust coming back up the road, saying..." They'll get out and say, "Charlie, there was one more thing." There's just something about this that just almost behooves us. It's almost like we want to get rid of all of it, get it all out there. And I saw no value in doing this until later on. Of course, that's the way this whole program's worked for me. I didn't see any value in doing any of it until I did it. And then look back at it and see the value. But after I did the fifth step, I realized that there's no human being can ever hurt me again by something he knows about me that nobody else knows. Because now there is another human being that knows everything there is to know about me. And I'm quite sure that Speedy knows everything there is to know about me. In the 20 years association that we've had, I've told him everything there is to know about me. So I've got two people that know about me, that know where I stand, that know the wimp I am, that know the fear that I go through, that know the doubts that I have. I've got two people. In England, this fellow I told you about that was at the Big Book Study in Albany, he said in England, when your sponsor dies, you immediately get another sponsor and do another fifth step with him. Or if your sponsor were to get drunk or pass away from the program anyway, so that there's always one person, at least one person on the face of the earth that knows all there is to know about you. If we cannot or would rather not do this, we search our acquaintance for, let's say we done read that, hadn't we?
Notwithstanding.
Yeah, you know, it does say that we ought not to be organized, don't it?
Mm-hmm.
Notwithstanding the great necessity for discussing ourselves with someone, it may be one is so situated that there is no suitable person available. If that is so, this step may be postponed, only, however, if we hold ourselves in complete readiness to go through with it at the first opportunity. We say this because we are very anxious that we talk to the right person. It is important that he be able to keep a confidence, that he fully understand and approve what we're driving at, that he will not try to change our plan, but he must not use this as a mere excuse to postpone. When we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory and we were prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approached in this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by our confidence. Now, what do I have to do? And the fifth step has told me what I need to do in this area. We pocket our pride and go to it. And we're going to get some more promises in here now. We got five promises in this paragraph. They're called the 75 promises, I'm told, on account of being on page 75. But be that as it may, we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The beginning of the spiritual experience or spiritual awakening, or the personality change sufficient to stay sober, begins when we have completed step five. That's what it says, isn't it? We've had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have the vital spiritual experience. Butch?
We're getting rid of self-centered fear because we're identifying. When I know what I'm afraid of, then I no longer have to be afraid of it, and that's what this is doing for me. It's beginning to do this for me. I counted six or seven promises there, but who's counting? I know that when I did a fifth step with Bob here, I just went right ahead and told him about that. And then we talked about a few other things, and we did not go into a long situation. I did, however, in my first attempt, learn what was expected of me to do as I continued to practice. And then I soon after that went to my first big book study with Joe and Charlie, and I have hooked up with a couple people that I continually clean house with, or let them know me, so that the main reason that I need to have someone close by that knows me is that when I am trying to identify a self-centered fear, and when I go to this trusted friend, they need to know me so that they can help me get to the bottom of this thing. They need to be able to tell me the truth, and it needs to be fast and surgical. The people that I do fifth steps with, that usually I go through a certain little prepared thing, and we do a third step prayer, of course. And we're getting ready to go back to the information that we used in step four and go over it again. That's the most helpful way that I've ever found to do it. We've got the information here, and we're going to go over the same stuff again, asking the same questions, making the same observations. But the important fact here is that between Bob and I, there is nothing to cloud the issue. See, I've got a lifetime of practice rationalizing and justifying. And the best effort that I could do at a fourth step was still clouded by that rationalization and justification, and, well, it could be a little bit there, and I don't think it's quite that bad. But when I sit down with another human being, they did not live my life, and they do not share all of my rationalizations and justifications. There's nothing there to cloud the truth. So when we go over it again, I'm getting the last ounce of truth that I can possibly get out of the information that I've put down on the paper. And for instance, and I've already told you about this, it concerned my sex life. And I said, Bob, I believe that this relationship was to boost my self-esteem. I was using this person to give me a sense of power. And he said, no, I don't believe that right here. He said, I believe you're just using that for a place to live. And so that is how I get to the most truth. And when I understand the truth, and when I can see the truth about how I continually reacted in this search for power, then it's no big deal. It is no longer any big deal. There is nothing that I've done that has not been done 1,000 times before. And this includes, at times I have to ask people, what have we done in the area of, have you ever killed anybody that you know of? I always ask that question because some of us may have. You know, I didn't, but many have, and it's not a time for judgment. It really doesn't make any difference. But this has all got to be looked at and understood for what it is. It's all history, too, by the way. It's another one of those history lessons, and history is something that cannot be changed. We do go right back to the information in step four. Let's turn right back to it.
Let me just say this right quick. As a sponsor, what I tell Butch may not be necessarily true, because I don't have any kind of power that Butch doesn't have. But my telling him that it was probably just for a place to live, it gives Butch the opportunity to look at it from a different angle and think about it for himself. I get a little scared sometimes when I say, I hear people say, well, my sponsor said, and I really want to say to them, but I don't usually, you need to remember why your sponsor's here also.
He probably said, could this be? He probably worded that differently. I don't want to get him in trouble. He probably didn't say, I think. He probably said, could this not be? Could this not be this? And that would allow me to ask and answer my own questions. You see how they're doing this thing? They're setting us up so that we get to think this is all our idea. They're not going to chop us down in any way.
Yeah, it took me a long time to understand that the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous was designed as a way of life, if I would participate in it, as a way of life that would help me to live joyous, happy, and free. I thought in the beginning that it was a form of punishment for the things that I did when I was drunk, That's the reason I'm having to do all this work, is because I got drunk and I did these things. I thought it was a punishment and not a reward, not finding a better way of living.
You've asked me to change, or you've told me that that's my only hope. And I cannot change until I see what's wrong. And this is where I see. This is where I look at the character defects that I'm going to ask God to remove. But I also look at the behavior associated with the character defects. That's what I'm going to have to do. I've done all this work. God's been right there the whole time. But I'm the one that's doing the identifying. I'm the one that's doing the owning. And I'm going to be the one that's going to have to change the behavior with God's help. I couldn't discipline myself because I could not see the need for it. I could not see how I reacted, and I won't be able to change until I see that. So this is all this is more fact-finding and more fact-facing. It's just done with another person, I believe, for more understanding and humility. So what I do, now this is my personal thing, is I begin to read the third step prayer, read right on through. We take a look at the same things. We most certainly go through the part about why we have to get rid of resentments. I make sure that we both understand that this is a vital and necessary step, that resentments have the power to kill us, and so does fear, and so does guilt. Guilt, however, I believe, is the only thing that is not God-given. We talked about how resentments were God-given. We talked about how fears were given to us by God because we needed them to protect ourselves. But guilt is a thing that I believe was designed by man to control man. And this is my opinion. I want to make that perfectly clear. I don't believe there's any room in God's world for guilt. So if I can see that right away, then that will help me get out from under some of this. It may take me a little bit of an educational awakening on that. But I do not believe that God has any use for guilt. We continue to read, if we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. We go over this stuff. Then we turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We begin to see that the world and its people really dominated us, and in that state, the wrongdoing of others fancied or real had power to actually kill. And I try to make sure that I understand this, and I understand how this can happen, because if I become restless, irritable, and discontented, I'm very likely to build up enough of it to take a drink, and then the truth will be gone for me until I ever make it back. Said we realized that people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick, and we look at the list and we go over that. We make all of these observations. But when we get to column 5, we've got something else to look at. This is the fifth step. How did I react? Now, Joe and Charlie point out 4 things in the book that pretty well cover all of my character defects. And these things are selfishness, dishonesty, inconsiderateness, and self-seeking and frightened. And I subject each of these things across the page. Now I'm going across the page now because I'm looking for it, each one, for the truth in it. And I take a look at that fifth column and I say, now how did I react to this person? Or how do I continually react because of this fear? And how do I react because of this guilt and fear associated with this harm I've done to someone else? And I found in my fifth step that I came up with large check marks or large bold print in the area of selfishness and self-seeking and frightened. I was certainly inconsiderate because I don't believe I can be the one without being the other. But inconsiderate was not my main defense mechanism. My main defense mechanism was selfishness, fear, self-seeking. I was certainly dishonest. I don't believe I can be the other things without being dishonest. But in my case, I came up big on the selfish and the self-seeking and frightened. Some people, however, it is my experience, make large check marks and large bold print in the area of inconsiderate and dishonest. It's just the nature of the personality. What we're looking at here is how do we think, feel, and act so that we can change and become the individual that we can live with. And when I like me, then I believe that my relationship with God is improving. And that is the only reason that I see for doing this. I don't believe that it's necessarily confession. It depends upon how you look at things. This is an individual. This is where the personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism begins to manifest itself in many different ways. But we use the same process. They didn't give us too many explicit instructions over here on what to do. It just says who to choose to do it with. It gives us a general idea of what to do, and then it tells us what's going to happen if we do it. It's always going to tell us what's going to happen if we don't do it as well. But this is the most telling and educational step that I have ever done in my life, and I use it. This is most of what I use on a daily basis. This is how I continually identify my discomfort, because I know that when I'm uncomfortable, I know where it comes from. It's self-centered fear. The only thing that's going to scare me in that area is a perceived threat to one of my basic instincts. Somebody's going to take something away from me that I already have, or they're going to prevent me from having something that I want. And I think that I won't say any more about that for now, and I'll let Bob talk for a minute.
Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. This is the only time frame, I believe, that they give us in the steps. It says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Page 59. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs.
The nature of our wrongs.
Carefully reading the first five proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall pass a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Now this is just telling me that I need to have done the first five steps, the first five proposals, to the best of my ability at the time. And by this time I do realize that this is not something that I'm going to do one time and then be through with it. It has to be done correctly, and everything has to be just right, just perfect. I'm going to get the opportunity to practice these principles the rest of my life. If we can answer to our satisfaction, then we then look at step six. Now, I'm not a great proponent of the 12 and 12. I know there's a lot of good information in the 12 and 12, and I think it's been misused. It was misused in my case, because I thought you could go to step meetings with the 12 and 12 and learn how to do the steps. And I did that for a long time because that's all we had. We didn't have any big book studies. Nobody talked about the program that I heard, okay? Now, they could have been having big book studies and talking about it everywhere, but I didn't hear it. And in the one of the things that I just totally and absolutely disagree with the 12 and 12 is the statement made in the first part of step six, where he says, a minister friend of ours says that step six is where it separates the men from the boys. Like it's some great big hullabaloo. And we're the ones, I am the one that just got through writing down what I thought was objectionable to me. I'm the one that just got through admitting to God, to myself, and to another human being the exact things that I'm going to ask to be removed.
Sounds like you've already grown up quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm the one that's going to ask these things. And I'm the one that wrote them down. I'm the one that made the proposal. I'm the one that's doing this. So why in the world would I be not willing to let them go? We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. And I had a hard time with being willing. I really did. They told me to just ask God to help me to be willing to become willing. And that's what I started with. I asked God to help me to become willing to be willing. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things? And I changed this word here. It says, we have admitted are objectionable. I put, I have admitted are objectionable. If I'm admitting they're objectionable, I'm ready to have God remove them. Now, these are the things that I see that are objectionable to me. things that are pointed out to me by the person that hears my fifth step as objectionable to them, I may not agree with at all. I may not be ready to look at those. But there's another sentence in here. Can he now take them all, ever one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us to be willing. Now this, I hate to even bring this up, but I will. Ever since I've been around AA, they've said that the prayer of St. Francis is the 11th step prayer. And I have never in my life been able to understand why. It's a beautiful prayer. I understand that. But what it's got to do with step 11 is beyond this little old country boy's imagination here, because I cannot see step 11 having nothing to do with St. Francis' prayer. Now, if it were about 6 and 7, then I could understand it. It looks to me like that's where the St. Francis prayer ought to be, because here we're asking God to remove the things from us. In step 11, we're just improving our conscious contact with God. Enough of that. See, I love a little controversy. When ready, now let's see. We need to talk about begin to change. What's the purpose of step 6? That's where I begin to change, and these are the least written about steps in the whole book, and the most important. I was told, you know, if you wanted to lose weight, you have to learn to eat things that you don't want to eat. Donuts. And you don't do things that you really want to do. You know, you don't eat things that you really want, and you make yourself eat things that you don't want. And in order to change, I've got to make myself do things that I do not want to do. And I believe I'm sober this morning, because there has been times that I have made myself do things that I did not want to do. And I have not done things that, oh boy, I really wanted to do. Oh yeah, and I just didn't, you know, one day at a time didn't do that.
Let me clear things up for me here for just a second, and let me look at my paper and just see just exactly what it is I'm want to be willing to do. I want to be careful here. What is it? What am I going to be willing to get rid of here? Selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking and frightened nature, inconsiderate behavior. Okay, all right. I'm willing to get rid of those, and I'm willing for God to take that. But it looks to me like I'm going to have to do a lot of changing. In other words, if I'm going to be a considerate individual, then I'm going to have to change the way I treat people, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm going to become more honest, I'm going to have to certainly change the way I've been doing business. So, okay, all right. All right, let's go on.
Yeah, to practice the opposite of the character defects, you know, the selfish, we have to practice being unselfish. Dishonest, we have to practice being a little bit more honest. Self-centered, fear, we have to practice a little courage. Now we're going to read the seventh step here, and I thought when we finished the seventh step that we'd just be pure as the driven snow. You know, and if God had taken all my character defects the first time I said the seventh step prayer, it wouldn't have been nothing but a puff of dust. Because that's all I was, is character defects. When ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step 7.
All based on the work we did in step 4.
Yep. All based on what we looked at in step 4, and learning to look at it from a different angle. A whole new attitude about the way we deal with people, and practicing the things that shut us off from the sunshine of the Spirit, practicing the opposite of the character defects. I have to learn to be more honest. I have to practice courage. I have to get in the car. Sometimes when I do not, when I'm scared to death, I have to do something as simple as just getting in the car. Go ahead, Butch.
Well, I think we ought to take a little break before we do 8 and 9, but I want to tell a story about a woman who's not an alcoholic, who seems right somehow. Now, on a daily basis, I talk with her. She's my other spiritual advisor, of course, when you're not available. I bought a little laundromat up in Maryville, Tennessee, and to this day, I really don't know why I did that, except the fact that the lady that had been working there for 17 years is the most spiritual woman that I've ever met. And I have the privilege of being in her presence every morning. This woman does not make other people responsible for her happiness. She understands that she's not responsible for anyone else's happiness. I have watched her take care of people who were sick. I have watched her take care of people who died. She takes no time off from work except maybe to bury someone. She doesn't need to work at this laundromat. She lives in a nice $100,000 ranch house out on the highway there. But she always has a smile on her face, and she's always immediately helping me look at things from a different angle. And this is such a joy. It is such a joy to be able to go in and talk to someone who intuitively knows how to live their life. Now, I think she took a drink one time. She got a hold of some moonshine when she was working as a teenager at the Wonderland Hotel up in the Great Smoky Mountains at Elkmont. And judging from what she said they drank, it's a wonder that they didn't die immediately of alcohol poisoning. But after two or three or four days, when they finally got back around, she made a decision right then and there that she wasn't going to drink anymore. And she hasn't. And she hadn't made anybody pay for that decision either. And I just wanted to tell you about her because she's a big part of my life. And I can learn things from everybody. But that is what I'm maybe will intuitively know how to live my life a little bit better because I practice. And that's what I see her doing on a daily basis, is practicing, doing exactly the same things that I do, that sometimes I have to look back in my book to find out what to do. This comes as natural to her as breathing. And I really want to thank her for her part in my life. I'd like to thank Bob for his part in my life right now while we're talking about it. And I think it'd be a good time to take a break.
Let me just say this right quick. I remember one time I was talking to this person and I told him, I said, you know, my wife won't even go to Al-Anon. She won't even go to Al-Anon. He said, you ever stop to think maybe she don't need to go? I said, hell, she's married to me. She has to go. He said, Judy is one of those people that intuitively know how to live. And you know, I started paying attention and looking for people that intuitively know how to live. And I see children, 4 and 5 years old, that by God intuitively know how to live. I got a little granddaughter that come through the house one time singing that Barney song. She called it Harney. But it was the Barney song, I Love Me. I love me. I said, Courtney, you learned that at 3 years old, and I'm 55 and just now beginning to learn that. But you already know that, don't you? And she said, yeah, I love me. 3 years old, see, intuitively know how to live right. Let's take us a break.
We'll throw rocks at the train.
Ouch.
We think they might have a curfew on.
I don't remember why. Charles, I appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, I do too. I just started doing it.
So let's see, where were we? Where did we stop? Let's see, we're on step 8, aren't we?
Yeah, you're not on my list, Bob.
Page 76, third paragraph.
76?
76, third paragraph.
Yeah, 76. The freedom, that's pretty close. Well, yeah, and here's that sentence again. Now we need more action. Without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. Now they tell me that the freedom comes in step 8 and 9, not from making the amends necessarily. We have to do that if we can. But there's going to be times that we simply can't make amends, or we can't make amends at this time. But the willingness to do that gives us the freedom. So we don't have to wait until we can get an amends made to Uncle Bill that we're not going to see except every 20 years. And I'll say this one thing about making amends. If you ever think you're going to be through with doing this, all you need to do is go to a class reunion or a family reunion or go back to your old hometown, and all of a sudden that guy that you need to make amends to will just show up on the sidewalk looking at you. Like, you know, they look at you like, well, when are you going to make the amends?
I don't believe that's what they're thinking, Bob.
We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends.
We made it when we took step 4.
Yep. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, here's a prayer now, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning that we would go to any length for victory over alcohol. Now, what do I have to do? What's my role in this? What's the action I'm going to take? Probably there are still some misgivings as we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt. We may feel different about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured, to some people we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment we are trying to put our lives in order, but there's not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. In the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. Why lay ourselves open to being branded fanatics or religious bores or big book thumpers? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message, but our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He is going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than our talk of spiritual discoveries. The lectures and advice you give are undoubtedly wise and true, but I'm kind of slow and I'll have to learn by always watching you. You know, the demonstration that I do in making amends is going to mean a whole lot more to a person than me just saying I'm sorry. They tell me that the Constitution of the United States has 23 different amendments, or more. I don't know. I think 23. Anyway, in none of them does it say we're sorry, beat us. It says, well, this is what we did. And later on we found out that this was wrong. We know better now. And this is what we're going to do to make it right. And that's what an amends to me is. I know better now, and I'm going to do what I can do to make it right.
But before we get into how we're going to do this, I want to think about this willingness for just a minute. because I've got a keen alcoholic intellectual mind, and this mind is telling me it's already going over that small list of people that I know that I may never run into. And I'm thinking, well, I don't even have to be willing to make amends to them because I know that I'll never run into them. I believe that's one of the main reasons that they gave me this set of instructions, is that I become willing to the list, no matter what. Because if I am not willing, I may drink. I may carry so much restlessness, irritability, and discontentment about a certain amend that I will eventually drink. And I've got to be willing, because this man may show up, like Bob says, on the sidewalk. There's one guy in Gatlinburg. I was about 16 years old, and this man had asked me to go over there and run a little arcade for him. Slot cars and video machines, or the forerunner of the video. I guess they had video machines then. And I drank up all the money. I mean, I just drank up all the money. He came over at the end of the summer, and I didn't have enough money to get him out of town. And I really didn't know what had happened to it. It was that sad. And he just walked off disgusted. He was disgusted. And I'm willing, when I can find that gentleman, to make amends, to arrive at some sort of monetary figure, and to make some sort of arrangements to pay him back if he asks for it. I mean, I'm going to offer. But if he doesn't refuse, then I am willing to take care of that little problem. But I could have very easily left that off, because I don't know where Ron is. And that's just part of the amends and part of the willingness part. That's why I think it's important to talk about becoming willing to the list, because that mind of mine might make a few adjustments.
The summary of the steps says wherever possible. You know, there would be no way that they'd give an alcoholic a word like whenever possible. And yet, if you listen closely in meetings where people read from the sheet or from a plastic card or something, or from the book itself, they sometimes will say, make amends whenever possible. And in my case, wherever possible, you know, the people, I was told that if I could make a list and divide it up, you know, I could put now, you know, I wanted to make amends to my mother and dad and to my brothers and sisters and to the aunts and uncles that I knew that I had hurt with my drinking. I wanted to make amends to them. I had no problem with that at all. I wanted to go to them and tell them what I knew of alcoholism, and that I had been sick, and that I was going to be better. I was going to do different. And then I had the people on there, you know, that I might want to make amends to later. And then I had some that maybe I would make amends to. I had a list of maybes. And then I had some that no damn way. Never. They'll never see me making amends to them after what they did to me. No, there's no way, see. But I found, just like I was told I would find, that the nows, when I got the nows done, or when I began working on the nows, that some of the laters began to appear, and I could do some of the laters. And when some of the laters, when I started working on making amends with some of the laters, the maybes started showing up. And then when the maybes started showing up, it wasn't too long till one or two of those no damn ways come on the list, and I had a chance to work with them. Now, for me, this is personal, but I don't believe you ever get through with this. I believe this is an ongoing thing, a life-going thing of making amends and straightening out the past and clearing away the wreckage of the past. I just don't believe I ever get it all done, because all of these things that caused me to be the way I am, I believe today, are children of the ego. And they don't go away. They just covered up a little bit and eased a little bit, but they do come back.
They give us a lot of information about step nine, because I think they knew that I was going to have some questions and that I did not know exactly what they wanted me to do or how to do it. So they're giving me a lot of examples about various types of amends, social amends, financial amends, sex outside of marriage. And I know that with my parents, for instance, it was two types. It was social and financial. I know that with my ex-wife, it was a couple of different types. And what happens is that more fear goes away. The willingness, like Bob says, the willingness removes most of it. The actual amends takes care of the rest of it. Now, my ego's involved here, and if I owe a man some money, I'm probably going to insist that I have at least $100 to take to him, or I'm going to have the majority of the money before I ever approach him. Well, that is the most inaccurate thinking that I had ever come up with, because it's in the approach. It's in the walking up to the man, I owe you money. He knows I owe him money. You know, this is not a secret that we're passing here. And I am now willing to do what I can to pay you back. At this time, I'm not doing well, but I have $5 a week. Well, if you come to some kind of an agreement, or even if you don't come to some kind of an agreement, you have done what is asked, and the fear is gone. The fear of that amends is far worse than any money that ever may be attached to it. Now, with the sexual amends that I had to make with my wife, I had been involved in some behavior that was not appropriate. And I did not feel it was right to give her any details, because that would harm her. What I told her was that I had misbehaved in a certain way. If she cared to talk about anything more specifically, that was okay, but that I was certainly wrong. I don't think that I used the word sorry too much, but I used the word wrong a lot, because I needed to know that I was wrong. And I assured her that while there was nothing that I could really do to make up for what I had done to her, because she had already divorced me, I kind of let her know that I was going to behave differently. And I think that I know it helped me, because if I've been involved with someone like that, I certainly want them to like me. I think that's human nature. We kind of like people to like us. And these are just a couple of examples of how this works. It is not a great big deal, and with money, $5 will buy the most relief that I could ever hope to have. And it's important not to hurt other people. It's important to do it face to face if possible. And they will tell us in here that if they turn us down or run us out of their office, that's it. I made my approach, an honest approach, and I'm supposed to forget about it because I've cleaned up my side of the street. So now we'll read an example of the man we hated, which is an example of a social amends. It says, we don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God. When it will serve any good purpose, we are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. And by this time, we're able to have some of both. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done us more harm than we have done him. And though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. I never use the word but. Simply, we tell him that we will never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so, never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the result. That is a very simple and powerful promise. If our manner is calm and open, we will be gratified with the result. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we are calling upon admits his own fault, so feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemy sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. Occasionally they will offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office, We have made our demonstration, done our part. It's water over the dam. Most alcoholics owe money. Now we're going to talk about what to do in the money thing here. You have a comment?
I just wanted to say that the purpose of making amends, I didn't see for a long time, I never saw any particular reason for doing this. You know, for my benefit especially, and I asked around and of course finally found someone that said I needed to put my name at the head of the amends list. And I couldn't find it anywhere in the textbook where I needed to have me on the list. But that's the reason I'm making amends. I'm making the amends so I no longer have to live guilty, full of shame and remorse. I'm making the amends to clear me up so I can live happy, joyous, and free. One of the guys that I sponsor called my wife, or called me one time, and I was working on the railroad, and I was working at night or working all kinds of crazy hours, and I was asleep. And she knew I had to go right back out, and so she told him, she said, "Well, he's asleep right now. Let him. He'll call you when he wakes up." And he said, "That won't get it. I got to talk to him right now." And she said, "Well, what do you need to talk to him about?" He said, "I'm making some amends, and I need to ask him whether or not I ought to do this." And she said, "You go and look in your big book and find the answer." And he said, "I done looked and it ain't in there." And she said, "Well, I ain't gonna wake him up. I'll have him call you when he gets up." And I called him and he was laughing. He was mad as hell at my wife. But when I woke up and I called him, he was laughing and he said, "You know, I went to the book right after she told me that, and I opened the book up, and there it was. It was just, you know, a whole paragraph about whether or not I ought to make that amends and how to make that amends and what would happen if I did." This chapter does cover most alcoholics owe money. We do not dodge our creditors, telling them what we are trying to do. We make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditors will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we're sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go. For we are liable to drink if we're afraid to face them. I heard a story when I first started coming around here about this guy owed a lot of money and he needed a bank loan, desperately needed a bank loan. But he knew that his situation with his drinking and everything, he probably wasn't going to get it. So he asked his sponsor, he said, how do you think I ought to handle this? And he said, "You go to the banker, be honest with him, and tell him exactly what's happened, that you've been sick with alcoholism and you owe a lot of money and you need a bank loan to get straightened out so you can get some of this stuff cleared up." And he said, "Well, he's not going to loan me any money if I tell him I'm an alcoholic." He said, "You don't never know." So he went to the bank and he got one of the vice presidents and he was talking to him, telling him the whole thing, you know, about how he had been in trouble with alcohol. And he said, all the time he was talking to that vice president, he was digging around in his pocket, you know. And he said when he got through telling him his story, he laid a 20-year chip out on the table. The vice president of the bank did, you know. And the guy did get the loan, I guess. But honesty, honesty is really the only way we've got to go. Because if I go somewhere and tell those lies that I used to tell, then I've got to continue telling those lies.
You'll forget.
I'll forget what lie I told. But if I just go on and tell somebody the truth and get it over with, the worst possible thing that can happen is, like it says, they can throw me out of their office. Making amends is not a form of punishment. Again, this whole program is designed for me to live happy, joyous, and free. We better move on, Bush.
I'm trying to have a personality change, change the way I think, feel, and act. And this is where I am actually going out and demonstrating what I'm learning about the truth. All of the work that I started in step four, based on the truths that I knew in one and two, and then I made a decision to change and I looked at what needed to be changed. I got more truth about what needed to be changed, and now I've become willing to change, and I'm actually going out and doing it. Now, this first group of people is just an initial practice session. What I'm going to do is I'm going to change the way I interact with people for the rest of my life, hopefully, using this same process. One of these days it may become intuitive with me, but so far it has not. I have to continue to study this book, and I have to usually study it with another human being. I believe it was designed that way. I can't go home and sit down with it and do much good with it. I've got to read it to someone else, or I've got to have it read to me. But this is where I learn how to change the way I react and interact with other people without that awesome fear. I am no longer dealing with all of that fear that drives me into those poor reactions. It says, perhaps we have committed a criminal offense, which might land us in jail if it were known to the authorities. We may be short in our accounts. Now, in a case like that, I think God's got more use for me right here in this big book study or in a meeting someplace or trying to serve my fellow man than he does in jail. But there again, I need to be willing to do it. I don't necessarily have to do it, but I need to be willing to do it. Because if I've changed, then I've been rehabilitated, and that's what they wanted to put me in jail for in the first place. So I believe God's will takes care of that. It says, we may be short in our accounts and unable to make good. We have already admitted this in confidence to another person, but we're sure we would be imprisoned or lose our job if it were known. Maybe it's only a petty offense such as padding the expense account. Most of us have done that sort of thing. Maybe we are divorced and have remarried but haven't kept up the alimony to number one. She's indignant about it and has a warrant out for our arrest. That's a common form of trouble too. Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. Now, principles, I looked that up in the dictionary and it said those are truths. So what are my principles? They are my truths for living. It says, reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience, we pray. We ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. And what is going to happen if I don't do this is probably going to be worse than any fear that I might have associated with what will happen if I do it. If someone pulls out a gun and shoots me, then I'm just dead. So what? What's going to happen if I don't? I'm going to drink, and it's going to be horrible, and I may take other people with me. You know, I'd just as soon be dead quick as dead slow. And that's where we all end up anyway. So this is really no big deal. It says, usually, however, other people are involved. Therefore, we are not to be the hasty and foolish martyr who would needlessly sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic pit. That's what we've been trying to do all our lives, and now it's time to stop. A man we know had remarried. Because of resentment and drinking, he had not paid alimony to his first wife. She was furious. She went to court and got an order for his arrest. He had commenced our way of life, had secured a position, and was getting his head above water. It would have been impressive heroics if he had walked up to the judge and said, "Here I am." We thought he ought to be willing to do that if necessary, but if he were in jail, he could provide nothing for either family. We suggested he write his first wife admitting his faults and asking forgiveness. He did, and also sent a small amount of money. He told her what he would try to do in the future. He said he was perfectly willing to go to jail if she insisted. Of course, she did not. And the whole situation has long since been adjusted. Before taking drastic action which might implicate other people, we secure their consent. If we have obtained permission, have consulted with others, prayed, we've asked God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink. Now, in my relationship with my ex-wife, or my former wife, I like to call her, she's already remarried. I do, the court said pay a certain amount of money, and I really don't even remember what that was. I try to pay what I can in the support of the children. But a situation arose where I might have to provide more than normal for some situation with my child. And I told her this. I said, "You are doing the driving, and I will do everything I can to support you." And that is the only way that I can see that it can need to be done. That helps me. It helps me know who's responsible for what, that I don't have to be responsible for everything. And these amends are on a continued basis. I made my initial amends to her many, many 24 hours ago. But I continually have to remember what my place is in this job of raising these children. And if I know the truth about it, then it's never any problem. If I begin to think that I've got more on me than I really have on me, responsibility-wise, then I won't be able to stand up under it. But the truth will always show me where I am. And I have a process that allows me to get in touch with the truth. Don't we, Mom?
Yeah. You know, I was thinking when I realized what this step was asking me to do, I stole enough money from the railroad to run a railroad.
Paper towels,
time, money, equipment. And when I started thinking about how am I going to make amends to them? I can't go tell them, you know, that I stole, because I don't know how much time I stole. I don't know how much time I was out there hungover or out there drunk or turning in time tickets when I didn't work, and claiming overtime that I wasn't due, and all kinds of things like that. I knew that I owed them a young fortune.
Just don't do that.
And I had to quit doing that, but I found a way that I could pay them back. I was on a reserve board, and they were paying me to stay at home. My dad always said they paid me to stay out of the way. They were paying me to stay at home anyway, so I went to work helping them with their alcohol and drug program, Operation Red Block. And I did a lot of work in Operation Red Block. And of course, they were having to pay me anyway, so it wasn't any money involved. And then I went to work Operation Crossing Safety. And I paid them back, you know, and I worked in that for 10, 15 years when I didn't have to. I spent a lot of my own money and a lot of my own time, but I made amends to those people, and I never did tell them what I was doing. I wanted to, you know, I wanted to tell them how great I was, but then I thought they might decide that it don't make any difference how great you are. If you're going to admit to all that, we'll just let you go. But now, see, what month is this, April? As of May the 1st, I'll be retired, so they can't... I don't know that I want to be retired, but I'm going to be retired.
It's not what happens to you, Bob. It's how you react.
Yeah. And I am not reacting well. Yeah, and I know what it is. It's fear of not having employment. Because I've been working since I was 48. I've been working for 48 years since I was 11, 12 years old. I've always had a payday. And of course, they're going to pay me a pension, but it's not like you're earning it. It's like you've already earned it, and I don't know that I accept that just yet. And it's going to be, but we'll move on because...
Could it be that you're not going to get to ride up and down the railroad and blow the whistle?
Yeah, that's got a whole lot to do with it. The doctor that is dealing with this problem that I have now, he had to fill out what they call a pathology report, and he had to send it to the company, you know, and in describing my job, he said, "Mr. Parmley gets to drive the train." And I read that, you know, and I thought, well, that's the truth. That's what he gets to do, because I still dearly love running locomotives. I don't like railroading. I don't like some of the people I have to work with and some of the things I have to do. But when it comes to just loving doing something, I have always loved running freight trains and blowing a whistle and waving at the kids on the side of the road, you know. I have always loved that life. I never enjoyed going to work and getting off in the same place. That always did just bother the hell out of me. If I'm going to go to work, I need to go somewhere. That's the way I was when I was drinking, you know. As soon as I started drinking, I needed to go somewhere and be doing something other than what I was doing.
A man told him one time, said, "Bob, don't you get tired of waving at everybody up and down the railroad? Most of them don't wave back. Don't you get tired of that?" He said, "No." He said, "It's not my job to wave back. It's just my job to wave."
Whether they wave back or not is up to them. You know, it's my job to wave.
And in most areas of my life, I need to remember that. It's just my job to wave.
Yeah.
It's not my, I don't have to worry about their reaction anymore. I'm not in competition with anything or anybody, including you. Go ahead.
Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. Now, this chapter here in this part of step 9 covers almost everything that we... I have never run into anything yet that anybody asked me or that I needed to deal with that was not somehow covered if I read this closely. But we're running a little close, I guess, so we're going to move on a little bit. Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. This is not something that happens overnight. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation, another prayer, that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. You know, I was told if we could just learn to be a little kinder to each other. The spiritual life is not a theory, squiggly writing. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. The lectures and advice you give are undoubtedly wise and true, but I'm kind of slow and I'll have to learn by always watching you. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. My wife has quit sniffing when she kisses me now. She just kisses me. But for about 10 or 12 years, every time I'd say, give me a kiss, she'd go, you know, sniff and make sure I wasn't drinking. And you really can't blame people for not trusting us. I was sitting at my kitchen table one time drinking a sugar-free, by the way, root beer. And my mother passed by and she said, I thought you gave that stuff up. I said, Mom, it's just root beer. And she said, beer is beer. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. And you have to understand that there are some that we just can't do anything about. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. We're willing to right them. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter, and there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping.
And we're learning how to do these things.
Yeah. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. I got a brother-in-law that every year, all right, I'll tell this and we won't put it on the tape.